There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.
This is Kate Magruder with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we'll be hearing from Vicki Patterson of Ukiah. Born in Manhattan in 1945, Vicki received degrees in anthropology and cross-cultural education at the University of Chicago before migrating to Mendocino County in 1969. Within a few years, she would embark on a journey of discovery and connection with the Native people of this county that continues today. Her PhD dissertation was on Central Pomo music. As we've been collecting these interviews over the past year, we keep hearing how the Back to the Landers created a new kind of spirituality in the county, a kind of mashup of Judaism, Quaker, pagan, and Native American traditions. I asked Vicki how it is that a white woman from New York City became such a well-known and respected consultant and educator about the First Peoples of this county. As has been true for so many of the folks we've interviewed for this project, she says the path just opened up before her. It was 1972, and she was hired as the director of the first Indian bilingual program in the state, a Spanish-English-Indian program.
So the Spanish and the English were the bilingual part. The Indian part was a cultural part. And so in order to work within the regulations, you had to work with the parent committee. And so I began to ask parents of kids who were in the program if they would join the committee. And little by little, I began to meet Indians. And one of the first people I met was Tom Ramos, who's Priscilla Hunter's brother, and his wife Judy, who were very active on the powwow circuit with their kids. They had a lot of kids. They were very active in the parent group. And I also met Margene McGee at that time, later Margene White. And then I met Priscilla Hunter, who I remember so distinctly. The first time I met her, she was sitting on a chair in my office. I was kind of very intimidated by her. But we became very close friends and still are. So through that, I began working with the parents to develop a curriculum. There was no curriculum. And so we had to think about, well, what do you want your kids to learn? Do you want them to learn language? What language do you want? Because there are 7 Pomo languages. And not all children who were Native in the Ukiah Unified School District were Pomo. When we did a survey, there were many, many Native people from, you know, Cherokee or Navajo or from other parts of the state, Yurok, Karuk. So we had a lot of discussions about what we should be teaching. And as I got to know the Native community, I began to be really curious about Pomo history and Pomoan peoples, because except for very academic ethnographies, there was nothing available. So that began my interest. I had no experience with Native people before. And then I went away, traveled through Mexico and Guatemala and Belize. When I came back, I was looking for a job, and I saw an ad in the Ukiah Daily Journal for an anthropologist. I mean, can you believe that? I said, well, I've got to apply. I mean, this is ridiculous. And it turned out to be the project at Lake Mendocino with David Perry in Sonoma State for the Army Corps of Engineers to develop an entire history of Coyote Valley and Lake Mendocino and what was under Lake Mendocino. We investigated every acre of land in that valley. And that project is where I met Scott, who became my husband and the father of my children, and really became involved in the Native communities through that project. And from there, I worked continually with Sonoma State to do other projects for the Army Corps and other kind of environmental impact statements, until I began to realize that they were really co-opting a lot of Native people through that process. I wouldn't do that anymore, and then I knew enough people so that tribes began to hire me directly to work with them and do ethnohistories with them. And I began to work on a big language project with Hopland and helped develop an orthography to write their language for the first time. And from there, things developed, and I began more and more involvement with Native people.
Were you aware of what the Native people you knew, what their perspective was of the Back to the Land people who were coming?
Yeah, they thought it was really funny. They thought they were weird. A lot of Native people at that period were very conservative. They weren't into the drug thing at all. And, you know, they saw people with long hair and beads and so on pretending to be Indians. And obviously they had some negative feelings about it, having their culture sort of being taken over in a non-authentic way. But on the other hand, they have a great sense of humor. They thought it was pretty funny. But some of the people, of course, were very sincere and really did want to learn from Indians. And they were, I mean, look how they accepted me. If you went sincerely, but at the time, you know, very, very few non-Indians went to Indian events. I was the only person in many, many years in big times or other tribal things. And, you know, I knew when it was time to leave, I knew that I wasn't totally accepted. There would be a limit to how long I could stay in a place. So, and I remember at first I was just incensed when I found out about local history, and I found out what had really happened to Native people was horrible. And I remember I had a friend named Ron Knight from Hopland who passed away. We had a big fight one time. We're both young, you know, in our 20s. We had this kind of screaming fight. He was saying to me, "What are you doing? Why do you want to tell these terrible stories? Why do you want everybody to know these terrible things?" And I said, "Because they have to know. They have to know the real history, what really happened." And he said to me, "What do you think the impact of this is on young Indians? How are they going to respond to knowing all this?" And it really opened my eyes to how limited my perspective was. Yes, it was terrible. Yes, it is a story that needed to be told. But other stories also needed to be told. Stories of resistance, stories of heroes, stories of people who made a difference, who were not completely victimized. Really changed the way I approached the study of ethnohistory.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. We're hearing from Vicki Patterson from Ukiah. We were given the opportunity to record this interview at the Grace Hudson Museum last year. It was a day of unusual activity in Ukiah. Throughout the interview, you can hear sounds of trains, planes, and automobiles, not to mention doors mysteriously opening and closing. Never a dull moment. Let's return to our interview with Vicki as I asked her what brought her to Mendocino County.
Chicago is becoming very dangerous on the south side, and it was during the summer of the Democratic Convention, which I saw happening on TV and immediately volunteered to drive an ambulance downtown, which I did, and I was maced. And after that, I was married at the time to someone who was doing a dissertation, and so he didn't have to stay in Chicago. We drove across the country to Berkeley, where my sister was living. We decided we wanted to live in the country, because at that time, everybody was moving to the country. And we actually rented a house in Boulder Creek, because it was near the University of Santa Cruz, so he could use the library. This is before computers, so you had to actually go to a library to access books. The weekend before we were supposed to move, some friends from Chicago came to visit us, and we all heard about Mendocino County, and we came up to camp on the Navarro River. And while we were camping on the Navarro River, we took a trip into the town of Mendocino to buy some food or something, and we happened to just walk into a real estate office and ask if they had anything to rent. And the guy in there said, "Well, we have this house, but I don't think you'll like it." And he took us to Little River, and there was my dream house, a nondescript house, but it was on a cliff overlooking the ocean. We forfeited our deposit in Santa Cruz and moved to Mendocino County. And we did it by renting a U-Haul, which, not knowing the county, we drove all the way up 101 to Willits, came across to Fort Bragg, and then down to Mendocino. And just south of Fort Bragg, the U-Haul broke down. And so we had no money. But my husband had a 12-string guitar, and he gave it as security to the Pine Beach Inn, who let us eat there and somehow get a tow to our house in Little River. That's how I came to Mendocino County. 1969 is when I came to the town of Little River.
And what were your first impressions of the county when you came, of the natural world?
Well, coming from New York and Chicago, I was extremely unfamiliar with the natural world, and I spent many nights in absolute terror hearing noises outside of our house. And there was one in particular, this pinging noise, which later on I found to be the heater making a noise. I thought it was some kind of crazed goat herd with goats milling around. Now, why I had that image, I have no idea. But I was completely unacquainted with the sea and with the West Coast. And I remember longingly reading the Mendocino County phone book and dreaming about Ukiah, which I had never visited except to drive through on my way to Little River in that roundabout way, because it had a pizza parlor, Rocky's Pizza, and it has Paul Rice Bowl. At that time, there was no pizza in the coast, no Chinese food, no nothing. But because we were, you know, sort of looking at a new way to live, we began to make friends, and people began to bring things like, I remember one day they brought me a deer off the road. It was butchered, but, you know, I didn't know how to cook it. Luckily, I had a cookbook that had a recipe for some kind of Cumberland Gap sauce for venison. Another person brought me an octopus they found on the beach. I remember the first time that I had abalone. Some old-timer in Fort Bragg told me to put the abalone on the lawn overnight so they could feed. I did it. I believed him. At that time, there wasn't a large supermarket on the coast. And in fact, later on, when 1970, I became the first Head Start teacher in the county. The school was situated at a building that was North Coast Opportunities Coast Outreach, and it was the distribution point for commodity foods. So you found a lot of commodity foods at various things, especially the cheese, which was free. You know, you could go there and get it.
What was commodity cheese like?
It was a block of pseudo cheddar cheese. I don't know. Lots of people lined up for commodity foods. And it was a big deal when they brought them over instead of having people having to go to Ukiah to get them. They began to distribute them on the coast. And at that time, in Head Start, I did have an unusual food experience with the woman who was the cook. Her name was, I think it's Addie McGeggy. And she was a longtime coast resident and had been at Camp 20 when they saw the Sasquatch. So she had lots of stories to tell. But she had nothing wasteful from that kitchen of Head Start. She used every single thing. She would take the tin cans and cut them with tin snips and curl them up and make dollhouse furniture from them. She would blow out every egg, and then she would gild the eggs and stack them and make centerpieces with them. All of any kitchen scrap she took to her chickens. Literally, there was not any waste from her kitchen. And so I learned a lot from her about how to be frugal.
How did the community in general, like the community that was already here, the people who were already here, how did they respond to you and other people who were coming from different places at that time?
So this is before I moved to the commune in Ukiah on the Warm Springs Road. This is still when I lived on the coast. When I got the job in Fort Bragg, many of my friends in Mendocino said to me, "Aren't you afraid?" And I said, "Of what?" They said, "Aren't you afraid to go to Fort Bragg?" And I said, "Not really, not yet." They said, "Oh, because people up there drive around with shotguns in their pickup trucks, and they don't like hippies." So, and I remember swimming in the Navarro River. I didn't own a bathing suit for about 12 years. And of course, I didn't wear a bra, because nobody did then. But when we went swimming, boys from Fort Bragg would park in their pickup trucks so they could watch us swim naked in the river. Shortly after that, actually, the fall of 1970, I moved to Ukiah to join a commune on the Mann Ranch because I had met Barbara McClintock through the Headland School, and she was one of the people that was involved with Larry Thomas to form this first commune on the Mann Ranch. I was married at the time to Andy Kaplan, and we were interested in joining a community at that time, and this sounded very interesting. It wasn't a cult thing. It wasn't held together by religion or by some kind of strange philosophy. It was sort of an intellectual exercise, you know, looking at creating awareness of some of the new and not so new trends that were occurring at the time. And actually, when I was at the Mann Ranch, it became kind of like the Esalen North. You know, we went, we met with them, we liked what they had to say. I think we had to put in $500 a piece or something to join, kind of. And we, you know, struggled a lot with what we were going to name it. We thought about the Greek name Paideia, but that seemed a little clumsy. So it ended up being the Mann Ranch. And there was a part of the ranch near the top of the Ore Springs Road where we began to develop some living structures. And I was part of building an A-frame there, tearing down some barns to get the wood to build the A-frame. And I lived in that A-frame for some months. I remember the first time that I walked down from the A-frame to the ranch house, again, not being very familiar with wildlife. It was in the evening, and it was about, I think, over a mile to walk down from that A-frame to the main house. And as I was walking, I heard behind me, and I was terrified. I thought, who could be following me out here? And I would stop, and I would listen. I didn't hear anything, and then I'd walk a little further, and I'd hear. So I started running, and when I got to the main house, I said, there's something out there. They said, how do you know? And I said, it's coughing behind me, and they all started laughing because it was a sheep ranch, and it was the sheep that were coughing. But I didn't know. Barbara mainly was the one who began to contact people to do seminars, and other people began to join our commune. One was a guy from the coast named Harold Respis, very tall, thin guy with red hair, who was an astrologer. And he had a girlfriend much younger than him named Tracy Elmtree. And they joined the commune. And then Joan Watts joined. I don't remember her last name at the time. She's the daughter, the oldest daughter of Alan Watts. She and her husband at the time, whose name was Tim, and she had three kids, were part of the commune too. And I became, because of my background, sort of the teacher of all the kids. And so I remember going to Lou Delsol, because we had nothing. He was a superintendent of schools, and saying, you know, do you have any old books that I could use? And he was so supportive. He wasn't at all upset. You know, he was happy that we had a little school going on. Anyway, he gave me a whole bunch of books, which was really nice. So we had school, you know, every day. And the group made food, and then we started having these seminars. And of course, Alan Watts came because his daughter was there, and Joseph Campbell, and you know, lots of other people, and it was very exciting. And people from the city would come, and they'd pay, I don't remember how much, to spend the weekend. And these, you know, in the ranch house, and we'd provide the meals, and the seminars would go on, I think, from Friday night through Sunday. And it was a very exciting time. But like many experiments in group living, the distribution of work was uneven, and some people felt more put upon than others. And there was the thing about who you're not doing enough, and you're doing too much, and you're not kicking in enough, and you know, that kind of thing. I remember some very serious gender issues in some of the early communes, where women were relegated to, you know, childbearing and kitchen work and gardening, and the men were doing other things. And I remember there being some discussion of that at the time. And I think because we had no overwhelming faith or shared philosophy, there was nothing really to hold the group together except goodwill. I began to look elsewhere, you know, as the community fell apart. I was still living there, but I began to look elsewhere for work, and I got a job through NCO doing some consultant work for Head Start. And then I was teaching classes for Sonoma State and Anderson Valley. And that was really amazing because I had to drive there at night over the hill. And I was kind of worried because sometimes I'd get to the top and there would be a blizzard. But the class from Anderson Valley was so welcoming. They were so happy to have a college class in their community that if I was ever late, they'd start up the mountain looking for me. So I was never worried after that. I knew that they, if anything happened, they would come and find me. So I did that for a while. And then I met Jose, who was living on another part of the Man Ranch, and he and I got together, and then I started moving away from the community, and it kind of fell apart. I remember the first Simple Living workshops. I mean, there was a sense, while my commune was in operation, there was a sense of belonging to that. We'd go as a group to visit other communes, you know, like the Albion Ridge and Navarro Ridge, and there was a sense of this whole sort of society of groups that were trying to create a different kind of life by building their own places, growing their own food. So there was kind of this identity thing you'd have, well, this is my, you know, I'm from this community and this community. And I remember there being a great sense of freedom and a great sense of hope and a belief, a strong belief that we were going to change the world, that we were going to change things for the better. And of course, there's a lot of LSD and psilocybin.
So what did mind-expanding experiences contribute to your choosing to be here or your experiencing of this place?
Well, I had experienced some things in Chicago, but it was a very different experience to imbibe ingest those kind of drugs in nature. And I had some very profound experiences, both on the Man Ranch and Navarro Ridge and other places, where I really felt like I understood the meaning of civilization. I understood the meaning of fire. I understood the meaning of groups living together. I don't know how to explain it exactly, but I did have experiences where I saw colors and where I remember sitting someplace in the chaparral and hearing, you know, I didn't know this before, that the chaparral puts out these seeds and you can hear them coming out of the plant. And that was really pretty amazing. And I remember just being in another place, in a different mindset. I remember reading the book in Watermelon Sugar, and that was very familiar to me. The whole sense of richness and lushness of the world was a very strong feeling, and the sense of freedom and being able to do whatever you wanted. And one of the reasons I stayed, and my husband Andy and I split up actually on the Man Ranch because it wasn't the right life for him, but I couldn't go back to Chicago. I just felt that I had been presented with this blank canvas and I had the liberty to paint anything I wanted on it. And that was too wonderful to give up. And so even though it meant the end of that marriage, I just couldn't go back. And so I stayed.
You're listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. We're hearing from Vicki Patterson from Ukiah.
Was there a time when you began to realize that the us and the them, that was beginning to soften? A time when you felt like who you were and the other and your friends and the other people who were the incoming culture was beginning to get accepted or assimilated?
Well, yeah. The only constant is change, and times changed. And I remember some of the changes, too, some of the not-so-good changes. When I first came to this county, it was very safe to hitchhike, because you knew somebody cool would pick you up. But after a while, the drug thing started to change, and from being sort of hallucinogenic kinds of drugs, people started using speed, and sort of a criminal element crept in. And people who innocently were hitchhiking were often molested or raped, or it became less safe to do those things. And so you could see the sort of the spirit of what had been in the 60s and early 70s changing quite a bit. You no longer felt part of this larger sort of hippie community that would be enveloping and safe, that there were elements that were not so safe. And along with that, you know, as people got older and became more affluent and began to buy property, began to separate themselves from their communities and became private property owners, began to have businesses, began to have careers, as they infiltrated the mainstream, of course, that boundary began to change a lot. I remember thinking a lot about this because when I was at Chicago, I went to a lecture by Timothy Leary, and he said something that I'll never forget. He said, you know, right now your parents are horrified with your use of drugs and how people are being hippies and dropping out and everything. He said, just wait till your parents, till you are parents, because your children will be putting electrodes in their brains and you'll freak out. And times do change, and that's what they are now, staring at screens constantly or their phone constantly. Even my 9-year-old granddaughter, I have to pry it out of her hands. But on the other hand, she has to tell me how to use my own phone. I don't know how to do it. So that's what happened, is that gradually as people became more affluent, bought property, became established, became the establishment, became elected to offices, became in charge of theaters, became in charge of school programs, became the establishment, the whole thing changed.
How do you think Mendocino County in general has been shaped by the fact that so many people came here in the 70s?
I think the liberal politics, I think our fight against GMOs, I think all of these things, you know, I don't know if they would have come from people coming later, but certainly the whole notion of living a clean, simple or life is still here. As you know, our farmers markets, our people growing food, our local efforts, I think are a result, perhaps not directly, but a result of the kind of people who came here in the 70s and who still continue to come here. I mean, I'm lucky my kids are still here and my grandkids.
Is there a memory, an experience that is emblematic for you of what this whole experience, what this whole movement, what this era meant?
I can't put my finger on it exactly, but there was, I don't know if it was at the Simple Living Workshop or a time when there was a big local gathering. I believe it was in Boonville. And it was just amazing to be there. It wasn't like Reggae on the River. It wasn't commercial music thing. It was just back to the land people from all over who came together. It was like a huge party, and you know, maybe we were high, I don't know. It was just a feeling of such oneness, such spirit, such positive energy. I don't remember the exact name of the event, but I do remember that event. And I remember that I was wearing this blouse. I had some clothes that, I don't know, they must have come from some theater. They were antique clothes, and I loved them. There was this sort of brown lawn skirt and this white high-necked lace blouse that had a net underneath and this lace on top. And I remember somebody coming up and saying, well, you can see right through that thing. And I said, so what? Because that's how we were. We would just be ourselves. We were just free.
So in that vein, how did coming here and staying here shape your life?
Well, if I hadn't come here, I never would have met Pomo Indians, and I wouldn't have had the life that I have and the incredible friendships I've had and the incredible understanding I've received about the original view of this valley. You know, to know something of the language and the traditional stories that go with it, to see this place that I was a newcomer to through the eyes of people who have been here for thousands of years, to me has been a remarkable experience. I never would have had that experience. I was not interested in Indians when I came. I wouldn't have had that experience unless I had been here. And I feel that as an anthropologist, I came to this very rural, at the time, fairly isolated part of the world. My parents could not understand how a New Yorker could end up in rural Mendocino County. They were totally puzzled by it. In fact, my father came up to the Mann Ranch because he thought I had been taken by a cult to pull me out. And yet, this is the place that I was able to actually become, actually live the life of an anthropologist. I've been very lucky because not only have I been able to, you know something about the native people up here, but I've also worked with the Latino community quite intimately, and I've worked now with the Asian community, and it's been a fascinating experience to see this multicultural nature of this community that many people don't recognize is here. It's very much part of what this is, and I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think that's part of maybe an expansion of the small notion of community that I felt at first, and now a much larger, more global-oriented feeling of community.
You've been listening to Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. We just heard from Vicki Patterson. You can hear short excerpts of this program on Thursdays during Morning Edition and longer episodes Thursday afternoon at 3:30. Archives of the program, along with photos, are available at kzyx.org and the Promise of Paradise Facebook page. Promise of Paradise is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, California Humanities, the Arts Council of Mendocino County, the Judy Pruden Historical Preservation Fund of the Community Foundation of Mendocino County, Story Center, the Mendocino Institute, and Grace Hudson Museum.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.